And at this time, I'd ask you to please help me welcome our speaker this evening. It's Alyssa, and she's coming to us from Front the Heart. Is that right? From the Heart. Oh my God, I can't read my own writing. Okay, From the Heart, that makes a lot more sense, from Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
Wow, hey, okay, I'm short. Hi family, my name is Alyssa, I'm an alcoholic. I love that you guys read the set-aside prayer here. I rarely hear that at the beginning of a meeting, and that's so good for me because sometimes I have to think to myself, God, please let me forget my attachment to my own story, whatever that is. You know what I mean? Like, that is such an egoic thing to think, like, my story, my life. So I'm going to try to set that aside tonight and just share, you know, let God speak through me the best I can. And I guess the point of that would be that I can't. So I have a sobriety date, which is September 1st, 2012. And I have a sponsor who's taken me through the 12 steps out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And as a result, I have the privilege of sponsoring other women in this program. And I do have a Hunger from the Heart speakers meeting. We meet in Lancaster at 8 o'clock on Wednesday night. 5th and Pearl, please come out if you're in the area. It's an awesome meeting, much like this. A lot of people, the same format, and we have a great time. I love being a part of that home group. I definitely do. And it's funny, I hope I get to talk a little bit about that because I did not want to join that home group at all, and I really didn't. I was really intimidated by it. There were so many people there, and that's like my home base in Alcoholics Anonymous today, which I love. And I have a commitment there. You know, I try to stay really active in this program as it saved my life. You know what I mean? I absolutely feel a responsibility to do my best to carry the message of hope that was shared with me. And thank you guys for being so welcoming. I walked in here and, like, I must have met 10 of you. That's awesome. And that's the experience I've had in Alcoholics Anonymous in general. Came into these rooms several times and I was welcomed with open arms. And I can't say that I was welcomed to many other places at that time in my life. You know, each and every time, you know, I really had burned a lot of bridges. So it's always a welcome relief to come to AA and be home. So I'm going to just share a little bit about what it used to be like, what happened, and what life is like today as a result of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and that's, you know, that's the important thing I need to remember here, like the what happened and what it's like today is because of the 12 steps and Alcoholics Anonymous and getting to know a God through the 12 steps. And that's when things changed for me. You know, what it used to be like kind of just looks like a bunch of different circumstances with the same feeling, the same underlying feeling. And, you know, I can't relay the feeling as much as I can relay the circumstances of unmanageability that my life had before I came to AA, before I really got sober. But that's how it was for me. You know, it was just always a feeling from the very beginning, and I really believe I was born an alcoholic, not because I had a physical allergy to alcohol that became known at that time, but because, you know, I had that spiritual malady, and I had all the makings of an alcoholic, you know. So from the very beginning of my story, I had this feeling, and I just describe it as not having a home, you know, and that sounds completely ridiculous because, as you'll hear me say, like, I almost sound like I came from, like, a very entitled, spoiled background, which I did because I demanded it that way, not because anybody offered it to me that way, you know what I mean? My parents were, like, really hardworking people who wanted to provide, you know, everything that they could for me to give me the best childhood and life that they could, and I'm just such a taker from the get that that's not how I see it, you know what I mean? Like, I know you have the money, so just give me your credit card, I'm going to go shopping, you know what I mean? Like, that's just literally how my mind works, and obviously I wasn't doing that at 2 years old, but as soon as I could, I did. So, you know, that's just kind of how I work. I've always been this selfish, entitled person, and it's not because my parents brought me up to be that way. Like I said, they're very good people, and I'm the first of three children, and I'm actually from Bucks County, I'm from Bucktown, and that's where I'm from here, and, you know, very early on, my parents my dad had to relocate for work, so you know, some of my earliest memories are moving around and feeling fear about that. You know, I felt very nervous, very scared about things like that, and I didn't know until, you know, hindsight is amazing. You know, it's the same with God, you know what I mean? I could have lived my entire life until I got here and had a spiritual awakening that there was no God. You know, like, there's a guy I know so much, like, there's no God, I can be the one to tell you. And, you know, like, what do I know? But hindsight is 2020, and looking back, I can see that I thought the feelings I had, maybe everybody else had at first. And then it quickly became apparent to me that that wasn't the case. You know what I mean? I looked around and I saw these kids that kind of looked like they knew what they were doing with life. And that sounds ridiculous as a young child, but I really thought, oh my God, like I don't know how to do this. Like, do they all have like older brothers and they're like really cool? Like, how does anybody know how to do this? Because life just seriously looked overwhelming to me. And what were my responsibilities at, you know, like 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years old? I didn't have any responsibilities. So, you know, I was moving around a lot and very uncomfortable, and some of my earliest alcoholic stories I can tell you. And like I said, you know, this is all in hindsight. Back then, I just was super awkward. And, you know, now that I have an understanding of the spiritual malady, I think it's very clear to me that I can tell these little anecdotal stories, and it's just a perfect picture of my separation from the world around me as I've come to understand the spiritual malady. And like, so like these kids, I'm just trying to be a normal kid, and like people have sleepovers and stuff, and I go to the sleepover, and like, you know, that's a big accomplishment. Like, I am a part of. And the problem is when I get there, I'm like super nervous and super shy, and I'm scared, and I need to go home. So like, lie about the stomach ache. It's really serious. I need to go home. And finally, they call my mom, and she's like, are you sure you want to come home? I'm like, I need to come home. Because I'm like full of fear and anxiety, and I don't know why. You know, I'm with my friends, but there's that feeling. I don't feel at home. And so I get home, and I'm like, oh my God, I'm such a loser. I need to be at this party. You know what I mean? Please take me back. I feel better. She's like, no, it's midnight and you're 8, so we're not doing that. And like, that's just how I felt. You know what I mean? Like, anywhere I went, I was uncomfortable, and I thought I needed to be at the next people, the next, you know, friendships, whatever it was, the next thing would make it feel better, and it never did. And I moved back from Europe when I was in just about going into middle school. Awkward times, you know, and I just really want to make friends. And like I said, you know, I am so selfish, and like, I can't settle for the first group of people that are nice to me. Like, I am that kind of person, you know, I take what I can from somebody, and then I'm not satisfied with that, so I move on. And the next group of people I found were people that were smoking cigarettes and drinking, I presumed, or whatever else. And, you know, it never occurred to me that that was like a bad idea, or I shouldn't be doing that, or my parents wouldn't approve. I did not care at all. I was all about that. And so I made friends with those people. And I don't really know how things got started for me, honestly, to tell you the truth. My mom recalls times that she was embarrassed with me drinking that I don't recall at all. For example, there's this religious ceremony that occurs when you're 13 if you're of a certain religion. Oh no, somebody sounds really upset. And so there's this religious ceremony, and what happens is you need to take a sip of wine at the ceremony. And there I am, down in it, you know what I mean? 13 years old, in front of this group of my family and my mom's friends. It doesn't make sense to me why you wouldn't drink the whole cup of wine. I mean, why wouldn't you? That's just idiotic to me, and my brain has never, ever made sense of the fact that you can just leave a half a cup. I mean, God, if you're downing Jewish wine, like, that's a pretty bad way to start your drinking. Like, it's only downhill from there, you know what I mean? And that's not a very high place to start. So, you know, that's how it was. And the first time I can remember drinking, though, I had a group of those friends over, and my parents went away a lot. And I loved that, and I thought, what a good opportunity to like really feel like I could get in with this group of people. And my parents had a liquor cabinet, and I thought, you know, this bottle looks cute. It was like Grey Goose. You know, I'm like, what's that? I don't know. The bottle's cute. And probably the most expensive free drink I ever had. And, you know, so I, like, broke open the liquor cabinet and had these people over, and I got drunk, and it seemed like everybody else got drunk, and the difference was probably, and some of them probably felt the way I did, because a lot of them ended up here, was that I finally felt like maybe I could do this. You know what I mean? Like, I looked around life, and I thought, like, God, thank you. I have a purpose now, you know? And that sounds bizarre. Like, drinking really was a purpose for me very early on. And I think that that may be a pretty significant trademark of an alcoholic, because I don't know that other people think exactly like that. Like, oh, yeah, I took a drink, and now I have a reason to live. And that's how I felt, you know what I mean? I looked around, and it made sense, and things were better, and my mind was just a little bit quieter. And, again, I didn't know that about that then. I know that about that now. But I did that a lot, and that really took off for me. You know, I wanted to do that as much as possible, and of course it wasn't every day. But as far as like a person in middle school or high school goes, it got pretty unmanageable pretty fast. You know, I found myself in a reasonable amount of trouble, and I come from a family with like pretty high expectations. You know, it's not like okay to not get A's on everything. It's not okay to miss school. It's not okay to, you know, get in trouble for, you know, selling baked goods in school. Like, that's not fine. And that's what I did. You know what I mean? And I did not care one bit about the consequences. You know, I was unhappy about it. But it never occurred to me that I should just stop what I'm doing so I can't get these consequences, because I needed to do what I was doing. I was getting a relief from it that I wanted to keep getting, you know what I mean? And eventually that became like a lifeline, an absolute necessity. But that early on, it was just kind of fun. And, you know, early times, just to kind of paint the picture, I mean, we would go away with our closest family friends almost every summer. And they had this lake house in Lake George, New York. Very small, nice community, these like upstanding people. And so my parents bring me and my siblings, and this family that we've grown up with bring like their three like perfect honor roll children, and like everybody's like that except for me. And because I'm like on the honor roll, right? Because like I can't like let my parents down completely, but like I'm just gonna like almost fail out of that. And there we are, and we hear this like lake party's happening, like down the way there's this kid having this big party, and of course we have to be there. And so we sneak out and we go, and you know, like that is so much of my drinking. I'm just like tiptoeing around, like trying to get away with things. And I sneak out and I get to this party, and I'm with this other girl, Katie. She's like such a good person. Like I can't relate to her at all. And seriously, like, so we get there and, you know, we make a total mess. And we get back in the house, and we're, like, not caught, and we're super happy about it, but we're, like, super drunk, like, I hope they don't wake us up tomorrow morning. And they did. They woke us up the next morning, and they had already gotten a call from the kid's mother, who had the party, and they sit us down. And the difference between someone like that and me is that, you know, they looked us square in the face and said, "What happened? We heard you were at this party. Did you guys really sneak out and do that?" I'm like, and she's just looking at them all terrified. I'm like, no, what are you doing? And she's like, yes, we were there, I admit it, it's awful, I'm so sorry. And I'm like, she's a liar. Like, why would you believe her over me? Okay, it's her word against mine, I'm sticking to my guns, you know what I mean? Like, I will stick to my story. You know, that's just how I am, that's just how I operate, you know? So it was a lot of things like that, and you know, it wasn't so severe so fast. It was always little things like the police showing up at my house, and I'm having little house parties in high school just because I thought like that would be cool. You know what I mean? Like I thought it'd be so cool if I did that. And really, like I'm a hot mess. Everybody's like taking advantage of my parents' house, and I'm like, I'm so cool. This is so great, and I'm just a hot mess because I'm an alcoholic. I'm the real alcoholic, and I don't have an off switch. I don't. When I start drinking, I never intend to get as drunk as I do. I never intend to rob people blind. But I just do, you know, I'm like an animal, like I'm just out of control, and it's like an out-of-body experience. And even back then, you know, the police would come to my house, and I'd have this elaborate story for why, like, there's all these cars but no people in my house, and why I'm super drunk, but I'm the only one here, like eating a banana, putting a penny under my tongue. Somebody told me you could pass a breathalyzer like that, you know, like just crazy insanity. And just little stuff like that. But what happens is I go to college, and I went to college because literally I'm in a family where you go to college, you do it. And I didn't have like a reason for going there except for that it was Penn State and you can like drink a lot. And that's the God's honest truth. You know, I had no intentions of doing well in school. I didn't know what I wanted to do with myself. It's super scary when everybody's like, oh, I'm going to be a pre-med major. I'm going to be, and I'm like, I'm just going undecided, and here's my fake ID. Like, literally, didn't know what to do with myself. That's the kind of person I am. I'm just floating around, hoping for the best. Like, maybe if I follow these other people, I'll figure out what the hell they're doing in this life thing. And you know, it becomes like a mess. You know, I had this high school boyfriend, really nice guy, we went to college together, and we got there, and I like pretty much like dumped him right away. You know what I mean? I was like, oh, we're college, so let's not do that. And I'm just a selfish jerk. I really am. And I believe that's all part of my illness. It's not to take blame off of myself. I'm being accountable for that. You know what I mean? I have a warped mind, and my perspective is completely off. You know, the disease that I have centers in my mind. And that can really go into any part of my life, and it still does today, especially today. You know what I mean? Because alcohol is not a part of my life today at all, and it hasn't been for a period of time now. So when this unmanageability pops up, you know, I know it's still my thinking this spiritual malady. I need to be closer to God and not running on self-will. But yeah, so things got pretty bad when I got there because I got rid of him and I found this other guy, and I found out that he was like the biggest drug dealer on campus, score. And I was like super proud of myself, like as if I made that happen, you know what I mean, which I did not. I did not make that happen. I didn't know that. Things just fell into my lap. I felt like the luckiest girl on the planet. And, you know, things got pretty bad pretty fast. You know, I don't ever have this line that I cross and I'm like, oh, that's probably a real bad idea to start doing that in that way. I'm like, wow, that looks like it really messes you up, and I really want to do that. So I do. I do whatever crosses my path. And, you know, it's pretty obvious to everybody around me at this point that things are not okay. You know, I drive drunk every day. I'm like, I'll be the DD. And they're like, okay. And I was still all the time. That's the sad thing. They were like, we don't want a DUI, but we'll still let you drive, even though you're super drunk. And that's how it was, you know. And it went from fun and working for me to not really quickly. You know what I mean? I threw some other things in the mix. And pretty soon, like, my roommates are like, why the hell are you doing lines at 7 a.m. when we're trying to study? And they're like normies, and they like don't understand, and they think that there's something wrong with me. And I'm like, there's something wrong with you. Definitely. Because literally, just like the book says, you know, our alcoholic life seemed to be the only normal one. And that's true for me. That seemed like the normal thing to do. I need to put something in my system to make this be quiet enough and relax me enough to get on with life, get on with living. And it was miserable. It's miserable. It's tiring. And, you know, my textbooks are gone. Everything's sold. I'm selling all my jewelry. And you know, pretty soon I have to come home, and at this point, you know, like I can't sleep at night without a drink. I'm miserable. I'm up sweating all night, and I don't know what's wrong with me. It really never occurred to me that I was going through withdrawal in these periods of time. And the guy told me it was a side effects. I was like, yeah, that makes perfect sense. It's side effects. The only problem is that like drinking is my solution. So, like, I can't just cut back. First of all, I don't have the power to cut back. And second of all, I don't want to. So why would I? So I'm going to deal with these side effects. And that's the way I lived. And I moved back to my parents' house eventually because I had to. Okay, so he moved back to his parents' house, right? Wow, that's funny. That's attachment to my story. So I didn't have to, but if you are me and you're as alcoholic as I am and you're so uncomfortable in everything you do, if you take one little piece out of my comfortable puzzle, like, I will crumble. You know what I mean? And that pertains to people, it pertains to, you know, what I'm ingesting, how much of it, the combinations I'm using, you know, whatever I'm using to fill that void at that particular moment. So I cannot let that piece of the puzzle be removed from me and just let that go. So he moved home, I moved home, and, you know, pretty soon I'm, like, going to therapy, you know, like, I'm so depressed at this point. They know something's wrong with me. I'm basically bedridden, and I show up to my new campus every day in my car, and I just cannot bear to literally walk in the doors of the school. I don't know why. I don't know what's wrong with me. I'm crying my eyes out. I'm terrified. I cannot imagine literally stepping out of my car, introducing myself to a class, and getting on with life, and I don't know what's wrong with me. Horrible feeling. And so pretty soon, I'm persuaded by the guy to check into a rehab because he found out how I was ingesting my alcohol, and he didn't like it. And I always joke about it, but when a guy like that, who's one of the biggest drug dealers on Penn State's campus, tells you he's uncomfortable with your drug use, I think things are pretty bad. So I personally felt like he had no place telling me that. But again, he was going to leave. My parents were going to find out anyway. And so I went. And my parents were like, this is going to be great. We're going to send you this place. Like, Aerosmith went here. Like, it's going to be great. You're going to be cured. I was like, perfect. And I got there. And I was like, you can't smoke cigarettes. I'm out, you know? And like, I didn't care. Like, I wasn't ready for anything. I always think it's an absolute miracle to get placed in a position like that where we can be removed from alcohol, because it's not the solution for someone like me. But, I mean, people are dying. You know what I mean? It's life or death. I know plenty of people who have died from this illness, and any chance that we have to be removed, I think, is a miracle in itself. And, you know, I did absolutely nothing that they suggested. I was told when I got there I'd be there for 4 months. And I said, no, I signed up for 4 days, like, shortcut program. Just detox me really quick and send me out on my merry way. And they said no. And my parents said, you're disowned if you do not do this and stay for 4 months. And I said, well, I'm going to do it my way. I'm going to stay for 31 days, call that a successful discharge, and then leave to go live in a crack house. So I did that. And I always joke, it's a little bit of an exaggeration, but, you know, I was living in this pretty grimy situation, and, you know, I can just tell you, like, at this point, you know, like, that was, like, a big turning point for me in my alcoholism. Like, I could no longer hide it, I could no longer deny it, and at that point, it was literally just me saying, I don't care, and I have to do this, and I have no other solution to stop. And I didn't call it that. I didn't know that I was living in a world where I didn't have a solution to live life. But that's what it felt like. So I did that for a while, and basically the abbreviated version is that what happens when you live like that is you have to do a lot of grimy things. You know, when you start living like that and your family's not behind you, and it's, you know, please don't get the impression they didn't want to be. You know, they absolutely have been exceptional parents, exceptional family. I think they were absolutely shocked to find out that their kid was, you know, was somebody doing the stuff I was doing. I mean, they just couldn't fathom it. And they supported me in every way they could. And the rehab said, you know, if she's not going to comply, then you probably shouldn't enable her. And they were like, we'll do anything to help her. You know what I mean? And they're shocked that this, like, awesome celebrity rehab didn't fix me. Like, what the heck? You know, if, like, money and, like, love and all that stuff could get me sobriety, like, I would have been sober then in that moment. And it just wasn't enough. You know, I needed a spiritual awakening, and that was something that didn't even cross through my mind at all for quite a while. But things got really bad really fast after that point. Pretty soon, you know, the times that I'm in and out of my parents' house, which is very brief, you know, it would just appear to the outside world that I would trade the $200 sitting on my sister's desk, trade my relationship with her for that $200. You know what I mean? And I know, I've been on the other side of this too, since being sober, and it's not fun. And it looks like, what in the world? I can't believe you'd give up this relationship for $200. Clearly, you're the only one here that you took. I didn't take it. You know, I mean, I gave up relationships. I treated that family horribly. And where I ended up, you know, I ended up in all sorts of sordid situations. I've had guns to my head, and I always think the point of saying, you know, like I've been in real dangerous situations, and not to qualify myself in or out one way or the other. You know, some people have seen a lot worse, and some people can't even imagine the stuff I'm talking about. But I was just stealing from people and ending up in neighborhoods where I'd get guns pulled on me, you know, was assaulted in all sorts of situations. And I'd walk around like that little girl in my like little Free People dress, and they're like, "What are you doing here?" I'm like, "In Kensington." I'm like, "What?" They're like, "Get out of here." Like, definitely blowing it up. And yeah, like I looked so out of place. So basically what happens is eventually I end up in Florida because we do that. I don't know. Does anybody have a good answer for that? If I had a dollar for every time I heard a speaker say, "And then I was in Florida," like really, oh my gosh, I could just quit my job, but I can't. So I was in Florida and I'm with a guy, and like I tried so many things to make it work, you know, and you know, trying to control and enjoy my drinking was that thing driving me crazy, like the book talks about. You know, try every combination to make that work. And so basically, none of that was working. Like getting a dog didn't work. Going to Florida didn't work. Stealing $30,000 didn't work. And there I was, thinking about jumping off my balcony every single day with nobody left to call and no ideas left. And I was so tired, and I had drugs in my system, and I had alcohol to drink right there, and none of it was going to work. None of it was going to work. And so basically I got on a plane, I went back to treatment, and I had pretty much no options left, and that's what I thought. And I had had one experience in Alcoholics Anonymous before where I had been at my parents' house, and they had done that thing where they're like, "We'll drop you off." And I was like, "Great, I'm sure I'm going to have a great time." And they dropped me off to AA. And I had had this group of women approach me. And what they did was incredible, you know, because I basically showed up at this meeting after, like, one of my awful runs, you know, and one of those runs where you're, like, hiding urine under your bed in case they drug test you, and, like, you know, going through some really violent situations and then taking all of your family's possessions. And I just threw all that stuff up all over these people. And they had really shown me what Alcoholics Anonymous was about. And this was in Doylestown in maybe like 2010. And this group of women was so awesome. They were having this big book study and they invited me to it. And they really gave me my first taste of Alcoholics Anonymous and that welcoming feeling that I kind of mentioned when I got here. If they were judging me, they did a real good job of hiding it. They were awesome. And so I had this sponsor, right? And I had a sponsor because, like, I knew you're supposed to do that, I think. And you know, so I had a sponsor by name, basically, and she did everything she could in her power to take me through the book. the only problem was that, like, I was showing up, like, drunk to step work, and with, like some drugs in my pocket, doing an inventory, and I'm like, "Why isn't this working?" And, like, I just couldn't tell her the truth about, like, anything at all. And she caught on to that eventually, but the point was for me that, like, that was a big deal, that I had had that experience, and that she had shown me, like, some unconditional love that, you know, that I hadn't really felt from somebody outside of my parents who deeply, I'm sure, resented me, but loved me unconditionally, you know, in quite some time. You know, I'd burned all my bridges with friends. And I also got a chance to read the book with her, and drunk or sober, I mean, those words resonated with me, absolutely. I mean, I knew what they were talking about. It was me to a T, you know, and that gave me hope. I thought, wow. You know, especially when they got to We Agnostics. I was like, me, agnostic? Okay, they know me. This is great news. You know, because I grew up in a household where I have one parent who's from a very staunch religious background, and the other from a very different type of religious background. And religion was a very dangerous topic in my household. You know, religion was something I used to manipulate my parents when I was younger. I'd have one parent trying to send me one place. I'd go to the other parent and say, look, I don't believe in that. You know, like, I'm definitely not that religion. Like, I shouldn't go there. And just, like, really turning my parents against each other just for the sake of doing it, really, and to get one parent on my side or whatever. I didn't care about religion whatsoever. You know what I mean? And this is not about religion. If you're new here, this is not about religion whatsoever. You know what I mean? I used the words higher power for quite some time, and there's nothing wrong with using those words, but I literally was not okay with saying God. I didn't have that type of relationship with a higher power that I do call God today, you know, that grew and changed into something like that. My understanding of God, you know, and to say that I understand that is, you know, that would not be true. You know, if I can fit God in here, like, I got a way bigger ego than I thought. You know, I don't. But I have this connection with this God today. And anyway, I got a little sidetracked there. But you know, I had this experience where I read We Agnostics with my sponsor, my first sponsor. And I think I knew that this is where I belonged after that. You know, I had a place to come to. And so when I'm leaving Florida and I'm leaving this next treatment center after feeling extremely suicidal and the definition of hopeless, like there's nothing left to do, I guess I'll try this again, you know, like as if I really tried it the first time. You know, that's what I'll tell myself. I hadn't had an experience here because I wasn't sober. It's really hard to get sober when you're drunk. And it's a good place to start, though. And so I leave this treatment and I go to this halfway house because I have no choices. Literally, like, nobody will answer my calls. I haven't seen my parents in quite some time. And that, again, is not their fault at all. And I literally had to leave everything behind to do that. And I talked earlier about how difficult it was for me to, like, just leave a guy. How sick that is. You know what I mean? That I was so sick that I literally could not take one piece of comfort out of my empty soul. And there I was wanting to kill myself, and I left him. I left him in Florida. You know what I mean? Like, I was that desperate to do anything to get sober. I could not do one more day of living like that. Just that exhaustion. So I end up in this halfway house anyway. And I didn't want to be there, you know. I didn't want to be there. And I went there because they said you can have your own room. I was like, all right, that's not so bad. And really, to tell you the truth, I had no money, basically. And I was lucky to get in anywhere. And for 1 month, I was dry as hell, basically. I didn't do anything. I got a sponsor who I never called. I did a lot of alcoholic behaviors that don't involve drinking and don't involve consuming substances. You know, I just did basically anything to feel better, and nothing worked. Super uncomfortable, super restless, irritable, and discontent. And after 1 month, for some reason, I stayed sober, and I think that has something to do with the fact that I prayed every day. And I prayed to a power that I didn't necessarily believe in or know or understand or anything like that. I just prayed because that first sponsor had told me to pray. And I always thought when she said that, I was like, listen, I'm not into extra credit. I'm not that kind of girl. And she was like, no, for real, like, spiritual part of the program, I'm not doing that. And then I come to find out, like, that is the basis of our program here. This is a spiritual program of action. I'm glad I didn't know that immediately. I would have been a little bit scared. But, you know, like, it's really not ever what I thought it was. You know what I mean? I had all these ideas that were just not true. And we're just trying to keep me out of here, basically. And so after 1 month there, I packed my bags and I went to York, Pennsylvania. And why anybody would run away to York, Pennsylvania blows my mind. I'm telling you the God's honest truth. But I had some friends from rehab there, And so I went there, and I'm so grateful that I took my will back in that moment and went to York, Pennsylvania. Maybe it was God's will, I don't know. That'd be nice to think about. But I went there, and I went to this recovery house where all these girls were doing something. And it was like, oh my gosh, like I almost had a spiritual experience before I even really delved into step work there. These girls were all about something. They had sponsors. They were going to meetings. And I just wanted to do what they were doing. I just wanted to be a part of. And I did that. And I went to a meeting. And I rolled up to this meeting like a bunch of dudes, right? Like recovery house dudes. And this woman that's now my sponsor, she comes up to me and she's like, "You're new." I'm like, "How does she know that?" And like, I had no idea. And she basically offered to sponsor me. And I'm so grateful she did that. I was so scared. Like, I wouldn't know what to do. I don't know how any of us think that we're super qualified to, like, pick a sponsor. Like, I don't know how we do that. But she picked me, basically, and she started taking me through the steps really quickly. You know, she said, "We need to get into action. You're dying here." And she told me about a spiritual solution, and she started taking me through the book. And almost immediately, you know, that obsession had been removed from me, but I was feeling super free. And I can't tell you, I mean, I have never had less in my life, you know what I mean? I had a terrible job. I had, like, a couple of people that I was barely friends with. I had my sponsor. I had no money. And I've never been so free in my entire life. Never. You know what I mean? Actually, I think it's harder for me, the more stuff I get, to get free when I'm not centered and I'm not, you know, being in conscious contact with God. It really is. I mean, when I had nothing and I felt that lift off of me, that freedom, oh, it felt so good, you know? I felt like I had been, like, asleep and, like, enslaved, like, my whole life. Like, I didn't know you could feel that free because I'd been so miserable and constantly, like, there was this impending doom in my life. And I didn't know it didn't have to be that way. And, like, stuff was happening for me really quickly. I was having a lot of experiences, spiritual experiences with the book, with my sponsor, with life. When my eyes opened, you know, and that's how it felt. It felt like, oh my God, like I can see life for what it is for the first time, finally. Huge blessing, absolutely. And I didn't know, and I didn't think that's what I came to Alcoholics Anonymous for. You know what I mean? I didn't know that I came here to enjoy life and see life in a brand new way and become awake and live by principle. I was like, I just need to not feel like that, and I just need to put the drugs and the drink aside. But I didn't have the power to do that. You know what I mean? And I needed all this to be able to live a life without it. I didn't know that. And I'm so glad. You know, I feel blessed to be an alcoholic. Only now that I'm, like, sober through, you know, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, so I feel grateful for that. I can't tell you that I'd be super pumped about that if I was miserable and dry. And, you know, I'm the kind of person that would just be thinking, like, in the beginning, I was like, but if I could just shoot up, like, occasionally, everything would be fine. You know what I mean? Like, that's a pretty alcoholic way of thinking. And to be in a position where none of that seems tempting or like a good idea. You know, nothing has come along in life that has made picking up a drink, ruining my life, my relationships that I've built with my family, like a good idea. You know what I mean? Like, we get this spiritual kit of tools for life, you know, and I got those through the steps. And so, like I said, you know, I'm going through the steps pretty quick, and oh my gosh, step one, huge for my life today. Huge. I usually think it's a step three problem. Mm-mm. Step one. Step one problem for me. You know, because if I can't admit that I am powerless in every aspect of my life, I'll never get to step three. I can't turn my life over to something if I can't admit that I don't have the power to fix it in the first place. You know, I grew up in a household where my parents thought it was an excellent quality to be extremely self-reliant. They're like, you need to do this, you can do it by yourself. And I was like, oh, I'll find a nice husband. And, you know, I didn't ever want to do anything by myself. But it's funny, when I get here, they're like, you can't be self-reliant, you'll kill yourself. And what a relief. What a relief for me, you know what I mean? I don't have to carry that burden. God has that burden. And I really started getting this relationship with God, especially around the time that I was making amends. You know, I had no family, like I said, and nobody that wanted to talk to me, at least. And they had visited me a couple times. They were very, very scared to do that because I'd hurt them very badly. But they would visit occasionally, and they'd be like, I know you don't have any food or any money, but we know that you'll just trade it with your dealer, like yogurt. And, like, literally, that's what it was about. I'm like, can I please have this? And they're like, no, we know you'll trade it. Like, I had these people so convinced that I could just take anything in their household and use it to get another one. I was not above anything, really. And, you know, so this relationship slowly started to come back when I had an opportunity to make amends, and I was very, very nervous to do that. I made amends to my dad first. My sponsor said, who's the toughest amends on here? I said, I think it's my dad. And she's like, cool, call him up. And, you know, I'll be honest with you, I was only a few months sober, and they're like, good for you, you've got 90 days. I'm like, this is huge for me, you know what I mean? To not have the obsession to drink every single day of my life for 90 days is like huge for me. And he showed up, and I was able to make that amends to my father. And it was really emotional, you know, like it was with all my family. We were super close. They're awesome, awesome people. And, you know, like my dad is like one of my best friends today. And I was always a daddy's girl. And it was a big deal. And he kind of paved the way for me because I made that amends. And I think he knew that I was sincere, you know. I made the verbal direct amends. You know, what I'm doing now is, you know, the living amends, which is probably far more important. But I had to make that first move to say, hey, you know, like I want to take responsibility for the things I've done, and how can I make this right? And, you know, I'll be paying amends for a very long time. And I make sure to do that. You know, I pay financial amends. I still pay financial amends 3.5 years later. I will be doing it for quite a while longer. And that's okay. You know what I mean? With my parents, they never cared about that. They really cared about, you know, having their kid back. I think like any parent would. And it's really great, the opportunities I've been able to have with my family since then. I'll try to get into that a little bit in a couple minutes, but he paved the way for me, basically, to come home to my family's house and make amends to the rest of my family, with exception of my sister, who told me to go take a hike, not so nicely, and you know, I think she knew things were changing for me a little bit. You know, things were different, clearly. I was able to hold a job, whereas in the past, you know, I'd held jobs here and there. Maybe it was more on the inside that it was harder for me to do that because I already had a job, which was like getting more all the time. And if that interfered with going to a job, like, I knew which one to pick first, and I had to. But for me, like, just to be able to show up, what my sponsor said, you know, go be of service somewhere, not only to your family, but to your employer, and don't be a taker, be a giver, you know, was a big deal. So I felt these changes, and I think my sister knew some things were happening, and again, she was like, big whoop, you know, like, be proud of yourself after destroying your family, you know, you got a couple days together. And, you know, it took 6 months, and she was telling the truth, you know what I mean, she's telling the truth. About 6 months later, I was able to make amends with my sister, and it's so cool, man. We're about to run a 5K in June together, and it blows my mind. Not, first of all, the fact that I can run 3.1 miles blows my mind, because I literally laid in bed and watched Storage Wars all day for years, okay, with a bottle of wine with me in Florida. It was really sad and depressing. But, like, I told my sister about this. I was like, I really want to try and do this. And she's like, I want to do it with you. You know what I mean? After all these years, we couldn't have this relationship. And, you know, it's unbelievable, things like that today. And, you know, when I get off the phone with her, for like a year, I'd say, bye, I love you. And she'd say, see ya. She'd hang up. And maybe just like a couple months ago, she started saying, love you. I didn't say anything, but, like, touched my heart, man. Like, I can't believe that. Like, the little things that maybe she's not even noticing, but, like, blow my mind, you know what I mean? That I can be a family member today, that I can go on vacation with my family and not ruin it for them. You know what I mean? Like, it's not any longer a panic attack for me to leave the state. That used to be a very big problem for me. Without a plan in place or like some money set aside, which to me would have been like $75, would have been like a good day. Like, I can do stuff with them, like whatever it is, I'm free. You know, one of my first jobs in Alcoholics Anonymous, not in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm sorry. One of my first jobs since I joined and became a member, an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous, was that I was actually a bartender. And I only say that to kind of paint the picture of how free I was. I don't recommend it to everybody. Go talk to your sponsor about it if you're thinking about it. But I talked to my sponsor about it, you know what I mean? And she said, you're free. You know what I mean? You are free. If this gets you closer to paying off your financial amends to your family, go ahead. And, of course, I didn't do it for a long time, and I left that job. And God's blessed me with a career that I couldn't have even imagined having, that I was totally unqualified for, by the way, and that an Alcoholics Anonymous member gave to me. Yeah, figures. You know, but that's where I was. And, you know, I'm kind of jumping around a little bit, but I was living in a recovery house, and I drove the scooter, and it was awesome. It was like red and white. It was like a little vintage looking moped thing. And that was like my mode of transportation, guys. So I thought that was a really big come up. I hadn't had a car in years. So I drive it around. I drive that thing around in like the snow. Like, it was pretty sad. And I would drive that to work, and I'd just be so happy about it. But one day, I'm, like, driving to my home group, right? So, like, I got involved in service pretty early on. My sponsor said, get into service. Have a commitment at your home group, you know, go to hospitals, institutions. You know, I basically just went wherever she told me to go. You know what I mean? Like, I was like, I'll go wherever. And I was sponsoring girls at this time and super scared about that, but, like, just willing to do whatever, you know. Like, I'm still somebody that sits in the front row every single meeting, like, pretty much every single meeting. At my home group, I will be there, front row, you know where I sit. So, like, very, very willing, and I think that's a gift. So anyway, I'm driving to my home group on this scooter, and I get hit by a car right in front of my home group, of all places, you know what I mean? Like, God's real in my life, okay? I'll say that. So I was in pretty bad shape, and my sponsor was there, and I mean, that's just incredible. I love telling the story. I wish I had more time to tell it, but what happened from there is I'm in the hospital. I'd gotten this relationship back with my family, and they said, we'll take you home to take care of you. You know, they trusted me at this point. I'm almost a year sober. And I was like, whoa, like, I think I'll cause more harm if I move home with you. So, you know, I had gotten into a relationship with another sober member of AA, and he said, I'll take her home. You know, that's principle, man. Like, he waited on me hand and foot for months. I couldn't walk. And he happened to live in Lancaster. So I moved to Lancaster, and I found another home in AA in Lancaster. You know what I mean? Like, wherever I go, I have this ability to be free, and you guys are everywhere. It's awesome. And I was in Lancaster, and like I said, I come to this huge meeting, and I'm, you know, really just resentful of the people there. I'm intimidated by you. I'm scared of you. I'm new again. I feel new, and I hate it. And my sponsor was like, you know, you join a home group to go be of service there, not because you love it there. And, of course, so I joined it. I'm the only female in this home group for quite a while. And I love it today. You know, I'm the intergroup rep for my home group now. And I love to keep a job. I'm somebody that needs a job in AA. I love to stay involved. And I absolutely love it there. And this home group has grown. I've seen this fellowship grow up around me. And it's such a blessing and such a joy. And life today, man, like, it's the little things, you know, really, honestly. I heard a speaker say not long ago, it's funny, we can only get about 3% of our story out when we're up here for an hour, and I'm about out of time here, but for some reason, the 3% that's coming through to me today is the little things with my family, you know, that I'm not a taker from them anymore, that, you know, I was just able to go on this trip, just me and my dad, and the kind of things that my dad says to me today are, you know, I learn more from you than I can teach you today, to hear that from my dad, unreal. My mom said to me, "I couldn't have imagined having a daughter as wonderful as you. You know, better than I could have hoped for. And that's not just because you're an alcoholic." And I think it is just because I'm an alcoholic, you know. So that's all I have to share. Thanks.